The word elegy. The word elegy comes from the ancient Greek elegia, from elegos, or lament, which back, way back, was used to speak mournfully about death and war and love. Those were all the topics for an elegos, a lament. And likewise, the word epitaph comes from ancient Greek, meaning the inscription on a tombstone, epi meaning upon or over, and taphos meaning tomb. Some words evolve so far from their origins, we are always astounded to learn where they came from, and others do not. They stay just the same. Thousands of years later, perhaps because they are words about the most essential and timeless experiences that people ever have, including mourning and preserving the memory of those we love. The ending of life pulls our whole system out of order. It literally dismembers. It pulls apart this body, which was our life, with all its limbs, all its parts, all its members, which made up our wholeness. It pulls this wholeness apart when a member is cut away by death. And all that is left of us hurts and struggles with the loss. How can this be? And why should this be? These are the questions and the recognitions of the heart that it's not right. And then the mind comes in and says, yes, it's not right. There must be more. So many answers to what more there might be. Maybe samsara, the wheel of reincarnation, that we all go through a long, uneven path towards the peace and final ending that is enlightenment. Or, according to Taoism, towards immortality that comes with wisdom and mastery and union with the Tao. Maybe death is not the end. Maybe, as we just sang, there is a heaven where we all get to be together forever, finally. And maybe there's also a hell where those who deserve it will get theirs. Maybe death is an ascension to another plane of existence. Maybe death is the end. Maybe life and death are exactly and only what they seem to be, part of the balance which makes more life and evolution possible. And we may make of those realities brutal or natural, as they seem to us, sometimes both. We may make of them what we will. In the end, it seems all people everywhere, regardless of experience or theology, struggle between dualities around death, acceptance or rejection of it, death as an end or death as a beginning, death as a betrayal or death as a fulfillment. Frequently, when I am at services for Christian members of my extended family, the minister or priest there exhorts everyone not to grieve because the deceased is now in heaven with Jesus. And I look around at the room of faithful Christian people who are also clearly grieving. And I think either a lot of people here don't actually believe what the minister is saying is true, or they do believe it's true, and it's meaningless anyway, because Jesus' gain is their loss. And their loss is real and devastating. In which case, maybe Christianity needs to find another way to try to comfort the bereaved. But it is not my job to fix Christianity, or even the ineptitudes that our own faith offers sometimes. inappropriate or inadequate things. I can't remember who the minister was once that said, the problem with us is that we don't have the thing that we need to say. No one is going to recite the purposes and principles as they're in a plane that's crashing to the ground. Yeah, it took a moment, and then you're like, oh. We have our own inadequacies. As we all try to wrestle with the awfulness and awesomeness of inexorable death. And regardless of whether it is an end or a beginning, a betrayal or a fulfillment, it is still always a loss. As surely for all of us as for any Christian or Muslim or Buddhist or Jew or pagan. And so in this church we honor this day. Every year we remember and lift up again the souls and lives and names of those we have loved and lost. And we remember the lessons and examples they gave us, what their presence was like in our lives and in this church and sometimes where they sat. Every space in this meeting house where you are sitting now, even as you may be thinking of someone you cared about, perhaps from here, perhaps where they used to sit. Every single space was filled with other people who sat where you are sitting or stood here in this pulpit and remembered others who had been here before and were gone. This space is filled, as much as our hearts are, by those souls lost to us. And I say in every memorial service I do, this is the nature of life and loving. We live knowing we will die, and we love each other though we know death parts us. And it's become a refrain in my memorial services because it is such a refrain in my own theology. This roller coaster of life is so mighty and extraordinary, and the power and the attachment we feel to each other is so profound and so real. And in the largest scheme of things, it is all breathtakingly brief and fragile. As the brilliant and deeply unwell poet, 20th century American Ezra Pound laid out when he said, "And the days are not full enough, and the nights are not full enough, and life slips by like a field mouse, not shaking the grass." Sometimes we rail against the injustice of death, the injustice which is death, even death that feeds life, even death that makes room for a new life, death which is in the end so necessary in this flawed system that we inhabit. The ancient Gnostics identified this as reflective of an essentially damaged nature of this world and this existence. There was this duality of body and soul, of corporeal and spiritual, which they saw not as a continuity that was full of promise, but as a division full of fatal, literally, flaws. And the only way they could explain the tragedy of human suffering and death was by reasoning that this flawed existence had to be the creation of a flawed creator. And only by enlightenment could we ascend in death to the true and perfect and timeless plane of existence created by a perfect creator. And of course, so many find meaning in acceptance. One of the best acceptances I know is by Unitarian Universalist, former director of religious education at the Church of the Larger Fellowship, Betsy Hill Williams, and she wrote this piece called The Space Between. There is a beginning and an end to every race that is run. The space in between is running. There is a beginning and an end to every game that is played. The space in between is playing. There is a beginning and an end to every book that is read. The space in between is reading. Some spaces are long, some spaces are short. There are marathons and 50-yard dashes, Monopoly and tic-tac-toe, long chapter books and haiku poems. There is a beginning and an end for everything that is alive. The space in between is living. She never actually speaks of dying anywhere in the poem. It's sort of like the mourner's kaddish, the ancient Jewish prayer that is recited for the dead, which likewise makes no mention of death anywhere, but rather offers gratitude and praise and ends with praying for universal peace. But in speaking or praying about the nature of life and its gifts, we make room also somehow for honoring what is sacred and lost to death. And in Betsy Williams' poem, we remember that we exist not only in space, but also in time, and that all time is composed of beginnings and in-between and endings, and that we find beauty and meaning in both the 50-yard dash and the marathon, in the tome and the haiku. And that can be a comfort when the tome or the haiku was the life, the body and soul of someone precious to us. Betsy Williams' poem is found in this Unitarian Universalist book for children. It's called About Death, and it's part of a series of little books about big stuff. And Betsy is one of the editors listed, along with two ministers, Jane Jepka and Ken Sawyer, and a lay leader, Noreen Kimball. Noreen was one of my favorite people. She was an extraordinary woman. She was a member of my home church and was beloved by very many. She was brilliant and hilarious. And she had an extraordinary way with words and with people. She was wise, and she was self-destructive, and sometimes unreliable unless you were in a jam, and then you could count on her 1,000%. It was only in her own interest that she wasn't always committed. She was more my parents' age than mine and spent much more time with them than she did with me, but she was also my friend, and she was irreplaceable. I still have a last voicemail from her on my phone that I treasure. How many of us have a last voicemail on our phone that we aren't erasing? Go ahead and raise your hand. I was sure when I was writing this sermon that she had died 3 years ago, and I looked up when I participated in her eulogy, and it was in 2013. So I guess I'm not resigned. There has passed away a beauty from the earth. William Wordsworth. Nothing gold can stay. Robert Frost. Poetry lifts up like nothing else, I think, the tragedy and miracle of living. And I was looking in poetry this week and found this in this fantastic volume, which I have mentioned to you before, Notes on the Assemblage by former U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera. This poem, Los Angeles Barrio Sonnet for Wanda Coleman, word caster of live coals of love, R.I.P. Wanda Coleman, word caster of live coals of Watts and L.A., you hear L.A. Yes, all the barrios and raise up the voice of the young and the bards inside, all the hearts blasting and keeping life alive in alleys become precious and courts where the jesters drill the king's coral brooch. It was Wanda who set the moat on fire. You, yes, pillaged bright and dug the core, the word, the sonnet in Coltrane, fix what was this American thing of race against race, you said. What was this underrealm where we tango in desire and headless hate and unborn and the fire wheels inside the blood, the bliss? Where? You, in the multi-night, in song silvered, in street rally quiver, a blues beyond. So you, prism now, under desert moon, alone, below and above, dressed in saguaro and chola and spike, we congregate and we dance uncanny. No mumble, we bow, place our hands open, face you now. Wanda Coleman, word caster of live coals of love, in gratitude we stand and rise. So much theology, all to wrestle with mortality. To find an explanation, a belief, a resolution of all we experience that could reconcile us to the losing of those we love and of losing our own lives. And I'm not sure, that has to be the ultimate goal. I'm not sure that it's not just as valuable, though surely more painful, to just embrace a sense of the worth and fragility of every life. To not struggle to be reconciled. If we operate from that foundation, to just embrace the absolute worth and fragility of every life, it makes everything about this time and our lives precious and urgent. If we do not focus on some better hereafter, something that makes sense of what is senseless, if we instead focus on the essential now, rather than spending our time hoping for more later, more life, more love, more peace, more abundance, more justice later, and in someone else's hands, something greater than us that will manage it all, and all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. Just as the great medieval theologian Julian of Norwich wrote, what if it won't? What if this is it? This life, this planet, this justice, this love, this life, this potential is it. If all this is it, then theologically, it gives us greater imperatives to live fully and to make it so that all people, heck, all creatures, can live fully. And if this is it, in the intimate scheme of our own lives, it gives us greater imperatives to live well and to make it that all people, heck, all creatures, can live well. It tells us, don't put off your dream. It tells us, don't put off your love. Don't starve your time of what matters most to you. Don't put off having children or spending time with those you care about. Don't put off the music you want to hear or create. Don't put off that art you've always thought about making or the place you've always wanted to see. Find a way. Don't put off the difference you know you can make in this world so that all can share in this shot at existence that we know we have. Don't put off the thing you need to say. Don't put off the risk that you know you need to take. Find the way. That's what we owe the fragility and boundedness of our lives, and that's what we owe those we have loved and lost and learned from. Their legacy is our living. They taught us to love. They taught us to love. What will we do with our hearts? And how will we honor them? They taught us to cook, to clean, to think, to care, to work, to sacrifice. This is the stuff of life poured into our hands, poured into our lives for our own living and for us to pour into others. It is the stream of life. It is living water that moves in and through us. This is what transcends time, even when we do not. So what if we cast our lot with Edna St. Vincent Millay, another word caster of live coals of love? What if we cast our lot with that fierceness and resistance that she channeled into her art and living? She used her not resignedness, her outrage, to remind us all that it is outrageous that this happens to us. It is outrageous. And it is real. And the best is lost again and again and again. And we ourselves will be lost. And maybe there's a way to tie that to Betsy Williams's poem. To say it is outrageous, and therefore, not despite that, therefore, we stand and we rise, and we affirm what makes it outrageous, the goodness, the blessings, the sacred. We remember, we lift up, and pass on the best that has been lost, that was given to us into our keeping. Remember, the etymology of which is not the same as dismember. Dismember, to pull apart, to cut apart, from the Latin dis, apart, and membrum, limb. But remember comes from a different Latin root, from rememori, and it has always meant to call again to mind. Even the etymology knows that remembering will never call back our loved ones to life. But remembering and mourning alone will also never be enough. We have to give our remembering form. We have to look past the reality of etymology to the reality of the heart, which is that no one lives forever, but we hand on the living of those we have lost. We hand on the living of those we have lost, and we hand on our own living. We hand on the best of everyone's living. That ultimate and most powerful gift we will ever be given, and the best gift we will ever give, our own live coals of love. Think about it. Live coals of love. When a fire has died out, the coals still glow, don't they? With warmth and with power, from which new fires may be lit.
Amen.